May I make the point emphatically then, that this country was founded on the religious basis, and that religious basis is Christianity. Maine, New Hampshire, Connecticut, Massachusetts, by Congregational. Rhode Island by Baptists who had been Congregational. New York by Anglicans, but mostly by Dutch Reformed and some Lutherans. New Jersey by Dutch Reformed, some Lutherans, Scotch-Irish, and Quakers. Pennsylvania by Lutherans, Quakers, Scotch-Irish, Presbyterians, some Roman Catholics. Maryland by Roman Catholics and Puritans. Virginia by Anglicans, Presbyterians, Baptists, not too many Baptists then, but there were some. North Carolina by the Moravians, by the Scotch-Irish and Scotch-Presbyterians, by the Anglicans, and a few Huguenots. South Carolina by the Huguenots, the Scotch-Irish Presbyterians, and the Anglicans. Now, I'm speaking now of the 17th century colonies. Delaware, a combination of Anglicans, but mostly Presbyterians. I know I did not use the Methodist for this reason. The Methodist Church did not appear in England even until the 1730s or 40s, and thus it could not have taken part in 17th century colonization of the country. I mean, no offense to the Methodists, just one of the facts of history that they weren't on the scene. Now, that's not the only point. I have made the point that these groups came over for religious reasons. Without exception, the Germans were divided between the Lutherans, the Pietists, like the Church of the Brethren, other Pietistic groups. The Anglicans were divided between the Anglicans, the English were divided between the Anglicans and the Quakers, and a few other smaller groups. The Presbyterians were solidly Presbyterian. Wherever you found a Scotch-Irishman, you found a Presbyterian. And by 1776, the Scotch-Irish were the most numerous homogenous group in the colony. A lot of people don't realize that. But because of the tremendous famines in Ireland, beginning in 1776 and continuing spasmodically down to about 1776, period of 59 years, there were three or four great famines in Ireland, and literally hundreds of thousands of people left. And they came to this country partly for just to survive, partly for religious reasons. The Huguenots came because Louis XIV revoked the Edict of Nantes in 1689. That's why my family, the Singer family, came over. They came over from Alsace-Lorraine, which was under his rule, and he revoked the Edict of Nantes, which had granted Protestants great many privileges in 1585, and so on. The point is that they came over as religious people, devoted to their respective denominational affiliations and theological convictions. I'm not saying it was 100%. That's foolish. But you see, I've heard Mr. Mondale and others make a very serious error. They say that the percentage of people belong to churches was small. Now, the sense which that is true, but let me show you why it's true. Suppose you had said that Baltimore's Roman Catholic, but you had decided to go out to, say, Hagerstown, Maryland, let's say, in 1730. Well, you can get to Hagerstown pretty easily today, at least from North Carolina. But if you'd gone from Baltimore to Hagerstown in 1730, you would have been intercepted by Indians, and there was no road. You'd had to make your way. The result was that no matter whether Presbyterian, Baptist, Roman Catholic, Congregational, what have you, and once you got away from what we call the Eastern Shoreline, and that would be the narrow settlement, from Jamestown to Richmond, Virginia, say Philadelphia to Lancaster in Pennsylvania, and New York to Albany, and Boston to Worcester, and just, well, Connecticut was fairly well settled. But you take North Carolina, where I live, we're 250 miles from the ocean. To go from say, Wilmington or New Bern, which were the two main ports, to Salisbury, 250 miles was a breathtaking and dangerous experiment. Now, the Moravians started at Old Salem, and there were Prussians around Salisbury. But you know, they didn't go to General Assembly and make reports every year. They didn't go to Presbytery. And Charles Carroll didn't go out to Hagerstown to visit Roman Catholic friends. If they wanted to see him, they had to come to Baltimore. He was about to go out there. I don't blame him. The result was that the records of membership in the church, say, of 1730, 1740, 1600, are 1760, are very, very misleading. They only took the members of the church which were nice and handy. But the people who went out to Kentucky, who went out to Western Pennsylvania, who went to Winston-Salem, Salisbury, were blue blood stock. In other words, this is a very fallacious way of carrying real membership. And very early in the game, that when they did come in the 18th century, the Methodists developed a circuit rider to meet this very situation. Presbyterian preachers had circuit riders. You know what they are?
Yeah,
I mean,
not for sure.
Well, they rode around their Bible. And there's a father, I'm trying to remember his name. The Roman Catholic priest did the same thing. He would take his communion set with him, and his Bible, and his mass, and around his horse. No, he didn't go that far, but they did go out to where Louisville, they go out in that section, or they go out to from Savannah up the river to Augusta, things like that, which was an arduous undertaking. They did their best, but we don't understand the difficulty they faced, both geographical and Indian. So that these people didn't come. Now, not everybody, no. But the man who in 1585, Richard Hakluyt, who wrote a book on the necessity of English colonization in the New World, used as one of his main arguments the need for missionary activity. Now let me impress upon you some further facts. In 1606, James I issued to two companies charters to establish colonies in the New World. The first was the Plymouth Company, which was given the territory really about from Philadelphia up to the southern boundary of Maine. And the second was the London Company, which was given at that time from the northern boundary of Virginia down to Carolina. As a matter of fact, it cut across about here in Atlanta from the coast. Now, in these charters, there was a charge, or a shall we say, a requirement that English common law, with its Christian content, be the law of the colony, and secondly, that it be as the hub or the base for missionary activity. In other words, the Virginia Company, as it was renamed in 1609, was given the task of being the center for missionary activity for the Indians of the South. The same thing is true of the Carolina Charter. 1663. All these charters contain provisions for missionary activity and for the establishment of English common law. The biblical concept of law were to be written into the colonial legal code. And that is true of all the 12 original colonies, and it may be of Georgia. I'm not familiar with the legal history of Georgia, I must admit. My brother lives in Tacoma, and I should be, but I don't. No. But just to say that in its legal system, these colonies had a legal basis. Now, what do I mean by that? A Christian legal basis. First, that the basic content of common law, both in its civil and its criminal content, was to be biblical. There would be no polygamy. There would be no incest. There would be no adultery. There would be no fornication. There would be no theft. There would be no murder. In other words, the prohibition contained in the Ten Commandments as to moral activity, ethical activity, were to be strictly enforced. Furthermore, the Virginia Company is enjoined strictly to observe the Sabbath day. Yeah. Same thing was true of the Massachusetts Bay Charter, 1630. And the Plymouth Company's charter, the Plymouth Charter, 1620, and the Mayflower people in North Carolina, at that time, that just one colony, the North and South Carolina at one time the same, had the same injunction. One of the principal founders of the Carolina colony was Lord Cartier, who was an exiled Huguenot from France. I could go on and on. The secretary for the Virginia Company was a man named Edmund Sands, S-A-N-D-Y-S. Do you know who he was? He was secretary treasury for the Massachusetts Bay Corporation of John Winthrop. Am I being clear? Now, what I'm saying is no secret. It's not something that Singer's dug up that nobody else knows. It's in the law book for Mr. Mondale to read. It's in the law book for the Supreme Court to read, if they can. It's in the law books for the politicians to read if they care to, rather than going around making tremendously false and erroneous statements concerning religion in the schools and this, that, and the other thing. Now, what does this mean in practical life? Let's take the whole problem of education. At first, of course, there were very few public schools. The so-called public schools in Massachusetts were not public, really. And I'm honored for it. The statute of 1634 did require that the people of townships, and of course, Massachusetts, lived in six-mile square townships, rather than the counties, like our counties in North Carolina and your counties in Georgia. How many counties in Georgia have? How many?
159.
We have 100. Now, I live in a county, the area of which is almost 600 square miles. And you can go 25 miles in most directions and still be in Lillian County. Well, now, you say that's not much. It's not much today. But suppose you live in the extreme southern part of Lillian County and your church or your school is up in Salisbury. Nobody's right mind is going to do that 50 miles round trip every day. And so the churches supplied the schools. As a matter of fact, the pastors were the teachers. There's a very famous church near us known as Thyatira Presbyterian Church. It was incorporated and chartered by the King of England in 1751. But long before it ever was recognized by George II, it was a meeting house, it was called. And nobody knows exactly when it started, but it seems to be about 1720. Dr. McCorkle became the pastor, and he founded a very famous school, right near the church, between the church and Salisbury. The result was that the schools were under control of the church. However, when in 1789, the legislature of North Carolina got a burst of energy, it founded the University of North Carolina. Ladies and gentlemen, what happened? The legislature called the Reverend Dr. David McCorkle, the Presbyterian pastor of Thyatira Church, to be the president of the University of North Carolina. Do you know what he did? He called Presbyterians to man all the faculty posts of any importance. And by that time, the Methodists and the Baptists did say, they did object to Christianity there, but they did say that the legislature had created a university at public expense which the Presbyterians would run, which was pretty much the truth. And that Presbyterian influence was dominant for years. The same thing is true at the University of South Carolina. So that when public schools did appear, and they began to appear in the 18th century, not in the countryside where the churches had it, but I say in towns like Wilmington, North Carolina, Augusta, Savannah, the larger towns began to have public schools. But what were those schools like? the scriptures were the textbook for reading in practically all those schools. And not only were the textbooks for reading courses, they furnished the content for literature courses and for what they called moral philosophy. Now, may I point out something to you? The Roman Catholics did not object to this. They had their own schools. There was no hue and cry. They were teaching the same thing in their schools. A little differently, I do. I mean, they used the Ten Commandments. They used biblical literature. And nobody regarded it as a violation of the Constitution. So they see, in the period under discussion, which I'd say goes down to past 1800, public schools of work and the many, many church schools of various kinds were turning out a steady stream of Christian young people. Which is to say that the consensus of thinking, the consensus of a political thought, the consensus in economic thought, the consensus in social thought, the consensus in educational theory and practice was biblical. It was biblical. Inevitably, the consensus thinking then among the political leaders of the nation would be biblical. The same thing would be true of the educational leadership. The same thing would be true of the social leadership. Break declared. Sorry. I'm giving a break. You want to turn off the... I had not dealt with kids, I intend to, but right now what I'm trying to do is to show you that we have a Christian heritage. I shall now discuss with you the Philadelphia Convention of 1787, which wrote the Constitution from May to September that year, from May the 17th until September the 13th. I want to make a sweeping statement as part of the general sweep of this course. And is it democracy and the Christian heritage of this nation are in deadly opposition. Democracy is the great nemesis of Orthodox evangelical Christianity. It is humanism and political action. There are two phrases I've never let my students use when I was head of the history department at Catawba College. The Civil War and democracy. If they called the war between the states the Civil War, I flunked them without any questions. They were court-martialed, hung, and shot. That goes for y'all, too. So if anybody in here from the North, be very careful of your terminology. It's dangerous. It has often been alleged that not all the members of the Philadelphia Convention were Christians, that some were deists. I'm going to treat deism, but that is not the issue. I have made the point, I've never claimed that everybody in the country at any given time was Christian. There's no such thing as a perfect Christian community. I'm under no illusion. I am saying, and did say, that in the 17th century, particularly, there was a binding, dominant, important Christian heritage, Christian consensus, involving the political, social, economic, and educational life of the people. No question about it. For reasons I shall discuss probably later tonight, certainly next time, this did diminish, didn't disappear, but diminished in the latter part of the 18th century. The war for independence was the product of deistic thinking or anti-Christian thought. Now, in the years which followed the war, well, really from 1787, life in the colonies was chaotic, or in the new state. Attack from within by upheaval groups, rebellions in Massachusetts and so on, war between the states almost, like North, like Pennsylvania and Connecticut, Virginia and Maryland, and the problem with the state of Franklin, North Carolina, and South Carolina, Georgia. Yes.
I know this is very simplistic.
No,
but
no questions.
Well, I think of the war of independence as being a break from the colonial powers.
It was. It was a war of secession. We seceded from Great Britain.
Yeah. Well, is that also the same a war of anti-religious?
The leaders of it, many leaders of it were deists. Not all of them. For reasons I shall come to. The point I'm making tonight is this. That at the convention of 87, whether they were all Christians or not, and they weren't, operated under Christian consensus. Now, and I'm not for a moment saying that it was an anti-Christian group. As a matter of fact, it was a very conservative group. When you have Oliver Ellsworth and Roger Sherman from Connecticut, William and Samuel William Johnson from Connecticut, you don't have a very radical group. There's probably no more conservative man in the convention than Roger Sherman or Oliver Ellsworth or some of the Massachusetts delegates. And when you have Alexander Hamilton from New York, you can hardly call it a radical convention. When you have James Wilson from Pennsylvania, you can hardly call it a radical convention, and so on. Or when you have John Rutledge from South Carolina, or James Ogle from North Carolina, a member of the first Supreme Court, a great jury. When you have Charles Pinckney from South Carolina, you can hardly call it a radical convention. When you have Abraham Baldwin, you know who he was? Don't you all live in Georgia?
Baldwin County.
Name for him?
No.
He was the most able of the Georgia delegates to the Philadelphia Convention. He was anything but radical. Now, what I'm saying then is that you have a Christian consensus. By the time of 1787, even those who were not believers were so ingrained in the colonial tradition in regard to law and the political system and the school system and the culture in general that they didn't know anything else. Or if they did, they repudiated it. In some ways, there were very few radicals in the Philadelphia Convention. Now, Jefferson wasn't there. Now, Jefferson was the most persistent, consistent, and radical rascal in the picture. Jefferson was a first-class radical. He was a flagrant, unyielding, nasty unbeliever, equaled only by Benjamin Franklin.
Hey, I've heard it said that Franklin wasn't a deist because he believed in prayer.
That same Franklin married the son, he married and stole the wife of his illegitimate son, William Franklin, the royal governor of New Jersey, had a wife. Franklin stole her. There's sometimes I didn't pray. Now, Franklin was tricky. He was deceitful. When he went to France as ambassador, he replaced John Adams for good reason. John Adams gave moral lectures and ethical lectures and religious lectures to the French. And to the court of Louis XVI, they were not widely accepted. You know, John Adams was over there as a minister of France, the Continental Congress passed sending him over, and then sent Franklin to help him. He wrote a letter back to the Continental Congress to wit that Paris is not big enough for both me and Mr. Franklin. Congress took him his word, recalled John Adams. But the Lord works in marvelous ways, as one is to perform. John Adams would never have gotten a treaty of the French. He despised the French and wasn't backward about telling them. When Franklin replaced him, Franklin outdined the French. He outplayed the French. He outdanced the French. and he out-immorallied the French. He stayed up all night, partying. He was very popular at the court of Louis XVI, no wonder. He was one of the boys. He got the treaties. He got two treaties in 1779, February the 6th. At the Philadelphia Convention, Jefferson was not there. He was ambassador to France from the Continental Congress. Franklin was. But now, to be fair, sometime between 1784 and his death in 1790, and I cannot tell you the exact date, Franklin underwent a profound religious conversion, at which time he penned his own, what you put on tombs, you know, epitaph, thanks. epitaph, I should know, it's a Greek epitaph. in which he said, "Here lies the body of Benjamin Franklin, who eagerly awaits the day of resurrection," and more, but that was the theme. In other words, he died in the firm hope of the resurrection. Now, that was not a deist position. It was not the position of an unbeliever. What?
Did you know that?
Yeah. It's in an old Episcopalian graveyard up in Philadelphia when I was in grad school. I saw it, and I can't remember. Yes, I do. It's Christ Church, which is one of those very, very old Philadelphia churches. You're from, isn't that right? You.
I think so.
Uh-huh.
You can see it from the sidewalk. It says something about he had hopes that he'd come back, or the Lord was going to raise him up
in
a new edition.
Yes, he said, "I shall appear," or something, "I shall appear in a new edition, because the Lord will raise me," which is obviously not a deist position, by very definition. So, I am convinced that he was converted, but I cannot give the date. But the date is not really the issue. It's the fact. Now, it was he who moved to open the sessions with prayer in the Philadelphia Convention. The point is that the work of the Philadelphia Convention reflected the Presbyterian form of government. Now, you see, only two of the denominations in existence, and well, three of them, had a well-defined pattern of government, apart from the Roman Catholics. And they didn't have in this country, because the early Catholic Church in this country was regarded as a mission field, and it was under the direct control of Pope, and the Carroll family had the financial responsibility, what they called the Secretary of Treasury for the Roman Catholic diocese. And it was suspected for that reason, incidentally. It was not popular in Rome at that time. Now, the Reformed Church in America, which was Dutch and was not too well known outside New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania, the Anglican Church, which they didn't want to copy, and the most numerous church at that time was the Presbyterian Church. And most of the men, not all of them, but most of the men who went to the Philadelphia Convention wrote a frame of government which very clearly reflected the Presbyterian system. The states were the presbyteries. The Congress was the General Assembly. And when the General Assembly sat at the court, it was the Supreme Court. The General Assembly is the Supreme Court of Presbyterianism. At the top was the executive head, the president. But the concept of the limitation of power has founded the Constitution, not only the Bill of Rights, but the whole Constitution is a definition of power. The whole Constitution is a definition of what Congress may and may not do. It has 17 expressly granted powers. That's all. John Jay, the first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, was a strict Calvinist, a French Huguenot, to put it mildly. John Rutledge, on the court, was a Calvinist Episcopalian from South Carolina. James Idle was a Presbyterian from North Carolina. James Wilson was a Presbyterian from Pennsylvania. And so on. One of the leading members of Congress was a man named Elias Boudinot, B-O-U-D-I-N-O-T, a Presbyterian, he was a Huguenot, but he became Presbyterian in this country. And I could go on and on with the
members of the Socialist Convention. I'm just sort of dragging names out hither and yon to give you an idea of what. But yes, ma'am.
Did that become the Presbyterian and other Presbyterians?
The Anglican Presbyterian.
Thank you.
the Anglican Church, until 1784, was under a cloud. They met in 1784 at Philadelphia, and he elected an American bishop, Bishop White of Philadelphia. But they had been so closely identified with England and the Episcopate of London that the colonies didn't have too much to do with it. It had to reestablish its American context. And the Roman Church was largely confined to Baltimore and Eastern Maryland and up in Philadelphia, some in New York at that time, to have any national influence. So there's no doubt, most historians, in fact, George Bancroft, the great historian of the 19th century, in fact, the greatest of those, makes this very point. You see, the Presbyterian General Assembly met in 1789, the first one, at the same time, the first Congress under the Constitution met. And there was an interlinking of ideas. Now I've established the fact that in its constitutional development, in its legal development, in its educational development, in its general cultural development, there was a Christian consensus in the country. Washington began the practice of being sworn in by the use of scripture. As a matter of fact, ladies and gentlemen, what does every member of Congress do when he's elected to Congress? What does the president do? What does the vice president do? Huh?
Swear on the Bible.
Swear on the Bible. As do members of the Supreme Court. As do the state governors.
Is that an open Bible?
Pardon me?
Is that an open Bible?
Yeah, they have their privilege of choosing the chapters, the pages where they want to do it. That makes no difference. The Supreme Court owns the prayer. The Congress owns the prayer. Chaplains, Army, Navy, Air Corps, Coast Guard, Veterans Hospital, still there. And so when Mr. Mondale saw me tell us you can't mix religion and government, as the Vice President of the United States, it was his duty to call upon the chaplain to lead in prayer. And Mr. Tip O'Neill makes the same statements in the House. It's his duty to call upon the chaplain of the House to lead in prayer. Now let me point something else out to you. If you use the year 1787 as a dividing line between the pre-constitutional period and the constitutional period, you take 1607 and 1787, you got a period of what? 180 years, don't you? Now, from 1787 to 1984 is 197 years, correct? Yeah, my math is still pretty good. In other words, our existence as a nation is only 17 years longer than the entire colonial period from 1607 to 1787. In other words, the legacy, the heritage, was part and parcel of the American political, social, and economic scene for 180 years in the so-called colonial period. And we've only outlived that period by 17 years. Now, when you have a heritage which is as widely accepted and influenced so many aspects of the political and the economic and the social and the educational and the general cultural life of people for such a long time, that heritage was well established. You'll be interested. George Morrison wrote a chapter for a book which Stanford Reed edited. You know Stanford Reed? He's a very close friend of mine. I wrote a chapter in there on the influence of the Scotch-Irish on American history. Scotch-Irish Presbyterians. The book was called The Impact of Calvin on the West. Now, I made the point that democracy and Christianity are inevitably involved in conflict. A conflict to the death. I'm not speaking now of Presbyterianism or the Baptist position or Methodism or the Lutheran position or the Roman Catholic position and so on. I'm not speaking. and speaking of historic Orthodox Christianity based upon the scriptures and the great ecumenical creed, Nicaea, Constantinople, Ephesus, the Chalcedon, second Nicaea, Constantinople, both. I'm speaking of these creeds. They are at war. Now, the war has been going on in this country since the 18th century. And they were aware of it. This is a John Cotton. It's on your page 18. Let's read it together. I'll read it and you find it. He gave this to the General Assembly of the Massachusetts colony. It was a political group. Democracy? I do not conceive that God ever did ordain it as a fit government, either for the church or for the commonwealth. Then he asked this question, which has never been answered. If the people be governed, who shall be governed? As for monarchy and aristocracy, they are both of them clearly approved and directed in Scripture. Yet so as refers the sovereignty to himself, and says that theocracy in both is the best form of government in the commonwealth, as well as in the church. Mm-hmm. Now let me hasten to say something. The Constitution is not a democratic government. It is a constitutional republic. It meets the test of John Cotton and of the Puritans. There's been an insidious, unceasing attempt to transform and to translate and to interpret the Constitution as a democratic document. If you will only read Madison's debates, which are easily available in any, well, they ought to be in the Atlanta Public Library. I know they're in the Emory Library and in other libraries of equal size. Georgia State, I'm sure, would have it. The statements of Roger Sherman. Robert Sherman said, I abhor democracy. John Rose was violently opposed to it. He wrote the sections of the Constitution on the court, so they'd be anti-democratic. Hamilton, Wilson, Ellsworth, Pinckney, Ardall. I'm just throwing out names as I think of them. Elias Boudinot. These men were strongly opposed to democracy and tried to erect a kind of government which would be undemocratic. Now, may I say, ladies and gentlemen, this is true. I don't fear for anything I've said to you tonight, for I can prove it if you will but go to the library and get the appropriate book. I may be shocking you, so I want to. Listen to this. Democracy, I do not conceive that God ever did ordain as a fit government, either for the church or the commonwealth. And we're not a democracy. Look at it. When the President of the United States takes the oath of office next January, he will not say, I hereby do solemnly swear to listen to the voice of the people and act accordingly. No. I take upon the oath what? To uphold and to follow what? The Constitution of this United States, the laws made in pursuance thereto. Marshall hit it right on the head in Marbury versus Madison when he was answering the first complaint of Marbury in that decision of March 1803. We are evidently a government of law and not of men. In the United States, law was to be sovereign because it represented the holiness and righteousness and justice of God and is related and revealed to man for his government. And Marshall was simply reiterating that belief in this great decision of Marbury versus Madison. We are eminently a government of law and not of men.
Dr. Frank, you're saying that the political strain we have is between being structurally if I understand you're saying that the political strain we have is being structurally a constitutional republic.
That's correct.
And emotionally a somewhat amorphous.
Emotionally it's chaotic. Let me. I'm going to get back to Jesus, but since I'm making this very strong point of the Christian heritage in political affairs, the constitutional nature of the Republic began to change with the coming of Jackson. The so-called much heralded rise of the con man was a disaster. I'm not speaking of Jackson's personal character. I'm speaking of Jackson as a president. he did. He popularized democracy, and he was very common. When he was inaugurated, they took from the White House the only bathtub which the White House could then possess, and they put it in the front lawn. They filled it with whiskey, and Jackson followed, dove headfirst into it, cracking each other's skulls as they got their fill. Jackson's friends swung from the chandeliers of the White House, pulling them off the walls and putting their hob boots on the furniture, and did tremendous amount of damage. What?
All for one,
one for all. That's right. Do you realize, with some exception, the day of great presence passed for good. The day of yes. Jackson was followed by him. Poor little used up Van Buren. General William Henry Harrison drank himself to death and died a month after his inauguration. Now he was followed by a good man who came in by accident. That was the Vice President Tyler, one of the most able men ever to sit in the presidential chair. He was followed by an able man, James Knox Polk. He was followed by General Taylor, who also happily died in mid-office. Then he was followed by Millard Fillmore, who was, he just filled the office up. And then comes Pierce. He was a fine man personally, but no nonentity as a political leader. He was followed by Buchanan, who I guess was all right personally, but he certainly was a nonentity. He was followed by Lincoln, who did more damage to the Constitution than any other president after Franklin Delano. Uh-huh. He was a very poor president. He was a very bad administrator. No, he didn't. Uh-oh. He didn't free his life. That's another popular illusion. the Emancipation Proclamation was only effective in that territory held by the Confederates. Now, how many slaves did the Confederates free in order to please Lincoln? It had absolutely no effect. It was illegal to begin with. You see, Lincoln said that the Union is not dissolved. The states are still states. And he could not free the slaves in the states. So he got around it by freeing them in the Confederate portion. He fooled the Negroes and the white liberals. That's all he did. You see, if he had, they wouldn't have needed the 13th Amendment, would they? Huh? I proved my point, haven't I? J. Trandall wrote a book, The Constitutional Problems under Lincoln. He was Lincoln's great biographer. He started out, he was at the University of Illinois, he started out with tremendous admiration for Lincoln. At the end of the volume 4, he had this to say, that Lincoln violated every important part of the Constitution on the basis of expediency. He misused money. He transferred money from one account to the other in the Treasury. He blockaded the southern ports, which was illegal. He called up the army when it wasn't a war. He removed ministers from the pulpits. He put people in prison. He undermined the currency.
He didn't have a central bank, and he just printed money.
He just printed money, uh-huh.
But he didn't have to pay interest on it.
That's right, and had no backing.
They had a Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve didn't have any backing on their money.
Well, they had more reserve than he did then. Until Johnson, the Federal Reserve did have gold backing. But the greenbacks didn't have 2 cents worth of backing, wasn't it? It was a completely illegal act.
They didn't do as bad as they're doing now, though, is Johnson.
No, he didn't. I agree. But you see, you have hit the point. He didn't do as bad as Johnson, which is to say he did bad. I agree with you. I said, under Roosevelt and Johnson, Lincoln was our worst president.
After Roosevelt and Johnson?
What?
After After Roosevelt and Johnson?
Until Roosevelt and Johnson.
Until Roosevelt.
He was our worst president, the most dangerous of the Constitution.
How would you like Woodrow Wilson?
Well, Woodrow Wilson was an able man who trusted the wrong people. He was a good man, personally, and he had ability, but he was misled into creating the Federal Reserve Bank, not knowing what it was created for, and he listened too much to Colonel Howe, which was like Mr. Carr listening too much to Mondale.
Well, what about someone who said that most of political leaders in the South...
A little loud, so I can hear you.
Someone said that most of the political leaders in the House, in the South, including House's father, and Jefferson Davis, and...
House was from Texas.
Yeah, Houston, yeah. But were Rothschild cotton agents.
That's been said. But that's not true.
Beauregard, General Beauregard?
Oh, you're talking about post-war period?
He was before the war. Before the war between the states, excuse me.
You're forgiven, but I... please don't offend my sensibilities to the breaking point.
See.
A lot of these rumors get started. No. The Rothschilds came in to the American picture after the war between the states, up in the 1890s. I'm not defending General Beauregard, but you do have to, remain historically accurate. What I'm saying is that democracy very seldom elects good people because it selects the lowest common denominator. Now, this is true up until Roosevelt and even past Roosevelt. The South saved the nation. I personally knew Walruff George. Dick Russell, his brother, was Presbyterian pastor in the Second Church in Memphis. I knew Carter Glass. I knew Cotton Ed Smith. And others. These men, standing as they did, saved the nation. Strom Thurmond. I know him personally. These men saved the nation. And they stood against the tides of radicalism, of Roosevelt and Truman and so on.
Did they veto bills?
Well, they didn't veto them, they just stood against them. Senate can't veto a bill, just can refuse to pass them. But as they died off, and men of lesser ilk, lesser ability, are more in tune with the democratic voice. The nation's declined politically, you can't deny that. I don't say we always always good, but I think Reagan's done a good job. I think Carter did a very poor job. I know you're all Georgians, but my daughter until recently lived in Georgia, and she did not support Mr. Carter. Neither did her husband. Today, all you hear is Democratic dribble out of politicians. Now, at the same time, that democracy is opposed to constitutional government, is opposed to church, is opposed to Orthodox Christianity. No question about it. I'll take that. This is going to be the gist of the course, but today, tonight, I'm laying the foundation. And I hope it's clear.
In the present situation in our government, how many are opposed to democracy in the House and the Senate?
Jeremiah Denton of Alabama. Sam Nunn would be. He has that good intention. Strom Thurmond, East and Helms. The fellow from Indiana, Luger. Isn't that his name? Yeah. And a few others.
The next thing, isn't there, I don't mean just us here, but everywhere, isn't there a terrible shift in, we use the term democracy so loosely and in so many ways. For instance, I think specifically, we're calling Constitutional Republic a democracy. We've done that. Then we've got this other ideal of this sort of egalitarian one man, one vote, everybody says the same mouth and this sort of thing. And it gets so many stuff. When we say democracy, we don't really know what we mean at all. I mean,
yeah, we go.
What I was trying to think is, I think that if we separate those meanings of democracy, it would be less difficult to cancel, emotionally.
I agree with you.
We've gotten so emotionally attached to the term that without really realizing exactly what we mean by it. I mean, I think when some people say like they're against democracy, as someone was saying a while ago, or asking about that, I don't think any of those members are going to constitute for a republic.
Oh, no.
I think,
I'm all for it, Tom.
Well, I'm not saying that you're saying that. I have this confusion about that.
Well, I'm probably confused as too. What I'm trying to do is get you to think clearly, because clear thinking is in tremendous demand this day and age. Not to be fooled by what you hear. I don't listen to news. I cannot take it. I simply cannot listen to them when they set up the purposely confuse the American people. Now, some do it in ignorance. Some do it by design. Sam Douglas is stupid. I mean, Sam Donovan just doesn't know the difference. The New York Times does. The Washington Post, I used to think it knew the difference. I'm not sure it does now. the Atlanta Constitution, I will allow you the privilege of deciding its case. Time Newsweek is only accurate when an accident happens. I mean, it has to be a pretty bad accident for the Time to get close to the news.
So what's your reason
for... All right. That's a good question. The United States News is fairly accurate. It's the best of the journals. the Wall Street Journal is fairly accurate. I get a paper. I'm a member of an organization known as Accuracy in Media, headed by Reed Irvine of New York. It's called AIM. It is very, very good. Because it doesn't cover all the news, but it's incisive and it's appraisal of the news.
US News,
you
mean the magazine?
Yeah, I'm in constant communication with John East and Jesse Helms, and sometimes with Tom Thurman. Yes, sir?
Do you have any feeling about the McNeil Air report? I thought it was a few notches above. And that
I think it is. Tell you the truth, I also don't know it that well, but I think it is.
At least on the purpose. They have people on different sides.
Yeah,
and they decide what they say.
I think it's better. I do see it once in a case. Sometimes my friends on it too. No.
The thing I know the end is completely, but if you're going to the premise that if we have a democracy, it's watered down, if everybody has the same voting privilege and so on, say that it just becomes a mediocre type
that's thing. It can't join up.
People who are educated and so forth need to read, people are trying. Why then have we not elected president to have the prerequisites for office?
It's a good question, leading question. I'll
and
take this up. I was going to say, our second greatest enemy is the public school system. It's the death knell of the Republic. It concentrates in majors in ignorance.
Okay.
Am I not right? I don't mean that all teachers are ignorant.
A lot of improvement in the name
of the day. Diplomatic, nice to see. Now, yes, and I would have to summarize and stop.
I'm just wondering if there ever has been an actual democracy. It's a bad idea that's never been tried out in the way you're using
well,
it.
Well, see...
Is there any such thing?
Stalin was quite correct that the Soviet is the epitome of democracy. Democracy is totalitarianism. The Athenian democracy, you know how long it lasted? 30 years. The French Revolution, the democratic revolution. But who wants the French Revolution? The Russian Revolution was a democratic revolution, but who wants that? Now, Kerensky was not a communist, and that's why he had to leave rather suddenly. Because he wanted a constitutional monarchy under Tsar Nicholas II. And that upset all of Lenin's plans to have a nasty man like Kerensky around, so he had to flee. Some people have wanted democracy as an antidote to monarchism, like Tsar Nicholas II or Louis XVI. Cromwell wanted democracy in England. He became a dictator. Democracy ends in dictatorship of some sort. Either that or the masses of a strong man. It can't do anything else.
Well, I'm just saying also about some of the egalitarian ideals. We don't have a democracy in structure, in fact. But are you saying that the egalitarian democratic ideals are really a danger to the
democratic
party?
Where you have equality, you can't have liberty. Where you have liberty, you can't have equality. There's no such thing as equality in the modern democratic sense. And when you try to enforce the equality, you are using force to achieve something which you shouldn't achieve and which you can't achieve if you did try, because the people who enforce the people are not equal. But see, when people enforce democracy, they're not equal, because they're using force to achieve their end.
Well, don't you think that really went into effect heavily in the Kennedy years when he started all of the ERA forcing them?
Yes, I do. Kennedy was a very evil man. In fact, all the Kennedys are. Richard Cardinal Cushing, turn this off, please. Excuse me, thank you. We have a Christian legacy which is not dormant today and which is being revived, but which has been discarded by many modern liberals, most modern liberals. But the attack upon it has been featured politically by democracy, because democracy, which believes in the sovereignty of man, cannot tolerate the biblical doctrine of the sovereignty of God. They're totally incompatible. You can't talk about the sovereignty of the people in one breath and say you believe in the sovereignty of God in the other. They're totally incompatible, contradictory positions, which is what really what Governor Cuomo was trying to hold last night, rather unsuccessfully.
Now, God said that all people are equal.
No, he didn't. Where did he say it?
What did he say?
I'm asking you. Don't. Oh, now you see that we're all created in image. That does not mean we all have the same gifts. I'm not denying we're all created in image. We don't have the same gifts. Can you be a Paderewski and play the piano? Are we Paderewski? Oh, well. What?
But we can all make equal contributions.
Can we? Could you operate for a heart transplant? Could you?
If I studied.
If you studied, well, sure, maybe. But suppose you have stubby fingers.
I did.
I didn't say you did. Could you sing like Pavarotti?
And you're talking in contemporary terms now.
Well, all right then.
But I'm saying, I thought God's law said that all men are equal.
No, what tell me where
it
said that?
It says that all who believe.
Pardon me?
It says all who believe accept Christ
are equal. Why, sure, I agree.
They're all the same in God's eyes, that's right.
Are they, while the lost men left and lost and redeemed all the same in God's eyes?
All is redeemed in God's
eyes. All the redeemed are. But is the unbeliever the same as the redeemed in God's eyes? We were doing in Greek, New Testament, in chapter 1 today, in our Greek class. God has looked upon you with a loving, piercing eye. Prioria, right? Yes, right there. And he's looked upon his elect with an eye of piercing love.